It's season two of the Carson McCullough Center's weekly We of Me. This is the second of three episodes based on our interview with Mary Dearborn, author of an upcoming biography of Carson McCullers to be published by Knopf.
This segment of the interview has been edited for time and content.
One of the things that Jen Chaplin and I talk about, I think it's in this most recent episode, is the war letters, which are fascinating to me. And, you know, of course, Jen Chaplin, her argument is that Carson was a lesbian, which you just said that you believe that to be true as well. And then, so when you try to square that with those letters, with, you know, what they both say, but what's most interesting to me is what Carson says. I mean, she certainly seems to love him. She certainly seems to me that she wants to get back together with Reeves. Now, you know, I can appreciate that it's quite possible that, you know, it's sort of out of a sense of duty. It's also she's anxious about his well-being. I mean, he is somebody very important to her, and she's concerned. But I don't know. What's your sense of that? Do you think that Carson wanted to get back with Reeves as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think those letters are amazing, fascinating. And I think I just read Jen Chapley's book. I didn't want to read it till I was done with mine. And I don't want to get into it really, except that in the case of Reeves, you know, Reeves was a terrible drunk, you know, and they definitely had sort of rough battles, them and David Diamond. You know, one of them would be trying to jump out the window, you know, one of the three of them. But I don't think that Reeves was abusive. I mean, I think that Reeves, no, I don't, I just don't, I think that it, when he was drunk, he might have done, but it wasn't even part of a bigger picture. It was so unlike him. And what I think's amazing about those letters, actually, first of all, he's a really good writer, and he really could have been good if he, I mean, he was constitutionally incapable of, you know, sitting down and doing that. I'm not quite sure why, but what I love is he finds some new way to tell her that he loves her in each letter. And I don't mean in a sort of, you know, I pine for you, you're the dearest, you know. It's more like when I think of how the first week I knew you, you did this. I mean, it's just every time there's something new, and he's not trying to dream it up. It's just something that, it's just extraordinary. And she's got to recognize that, first of all. I mean, she's enough of a writer herself, but also she's flesh and blood. And when somebody loves you that much and knows you that well, you know, you pay attention. And I think, you know, it's also, she was living in a homophobic time. And much as she surrounded herself with other writers and artists, which it wasn't always true, it was hard. It was a hard thing to do to be an out lesbian. She wasn't out. I guess you could say she was with Mary Mercer, but I mean, that's such a hard thing to characterize, that relationship. But the two of them, I mean, it's a respect for the institution of marriage that you wouldn't really expect in somebody, you know, a writer, a bohemian, to actually want, you know, to be married. And there were some things, I think, about his being in the army, you know, that she would get, you know, wives, whatever, benefits or something like that. Though I don't think that timing works out quite right.
Well, to me, she seems to, I think she's really proud of him. I hadn't even thought about that there might be a financial aspect to it. I guess there could be, but I don't know. Just what comes through in the letters to me is that she's very proud of him. You know, that he's gotten his life together and that he is acquitting himself so well, which apparently he did during the war. And as you said, writes about it so brilliantly.
Yeah, he came into his own. You know, when he was younger, he was an Eagle Scout, which isn't that common. And then when he was working in Fayetteville or Charlotte, those places, he was a scoutmaster. And he loved leading men. You know, and he was just apparently so good at it. He cared so much. I mean, right. The second thing that he seems to care about after Carson is his men. And, you know, and he's just, I think that's extraordinary. And the poor guy, I mean, in another world. He would have been a great CEO, but, you know, he would never, a corporate leader, but he would never consider that, of course, and probably would have hated it, but he'd be good at it. You know, he was good, just good at leading. And it was really sad that he never found any kind of place.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the few people I have been able to meet in my lifetime who knew Carson well as an adult. I've met several people who met Carson when they were really young, when they were too young to really know her, but they happened to be in her presence for whatever. But the one person I have met who knew her well as an adult was John Ziegler.
Really?
Yeah. And of course, this was late in Mr. Ziegler's life. He was in his 90s when I met him. He came to Columbus to visit, and we went out to lunch, and me and Mr. Ziegler and some other people. And one of the things that he said to me was that, you know, Reeves was really a fine person. You know, there's no question that when he and Carson were together, it was just a shame that, you know, they were in a lot of ways so bad for each other. But he said, you know, Reeves was very likable and was just very, that's the way he put it. He said he was a very fine person.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. But I'm not surprised. You know, I don't think there was, I can't think of anyone who thought he was like bad news or bad idea. But Carson's mother loved him. Janet Flanner and her partners both adored Reeves. And there was, and you can see it too. You can see a lot of his personality when from time to time he would take over her correspondence, like her business or whatever her. And those letters that he's writing, that's a different voice. It's a very much, you know, I'm with Carson. Kind of voice, and it's so, he's so likable. What's not to like? It's very hard for me to believe that. Believe me, I think if he thought he was being really bad for her, well, that's what he did. He killed himself, right? I mean, he wouldn't be with her if he thought he was really bad for her, but you can imagine how that destroyed him. It had to have been one of the factors in his falling apart and suicide.
Yeah.
Well, I was amazed at how the two of them both fell apart that year, especially, but really the prior 3 years. But well, anyway, it was a very sad time, and it was a bad time for her. And I think both of them behaved in ways that are kind of inexplicable.
Yeah, I mean, that's clear. And the things I've read about people who visited them in France.
Yeah.
I mean, it was all bad. It was like, even the people who loved them are like, you know, you just wanted to stay away. Here's something else that came out, and I was embarrassed because I didn't know this, and I'm curious to find out if you know anything about this, is that one of the questions I wanted to ask Jen Chaplin was, you know, in the manuscript of the unfinished autobiography, Carson had put in a note, insert war letters here. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to, before I even got to that question, Jen Chaplin said she had also wanted, apparently, her letters to Anne-Marie Clorox Schwarzenbach inserted in the autobiography as well. And I was I didn't know that. I had never heard that before.
I don't know how many letters, I don't think I've read very many letters of Carson to Anne-Marie. There's a lot from Anne-Marie to Carson, but I kind of question that. Yeah, I'm not a, I think the letters from Anne-Marie to Carson are not love letters. That's how they talked. And very, very much one-sided. We don't really see Carson's letters to her. But anyway, she's writing to Carson for complex reasons. And, you know, she knew full well that they weren't going to have a relationship in future and really hadn't in the past. Did it very briefly, maybe. And then they kind of kept hanging around together. But, you know, Anne-Marie was involved with that Margot von Opel, and she was still in love with Erica Mann. And, you know, I was just revising that part in my manuscript lately, and I realized Carson was so out of her depths. I mean, you've sort of gone from Columbus, Georgia to cabaret life in Berlin, you know? I mean, where everybody's kind of gender nonspecific and using heroin, as Anne-Marie did, I mean, or, you know, just drinking way too much and having a lot of sex, which Carson, by then, I think she hadn't had any sex with a woman, only with Reeves. And it was just, she was out of her depth. And they were emotionally complex and and older, quite a bit older. Anne Marie's almost 10 years older. She was really lost.
I've often felt that she was, I forget the word for this, when you were in awe of someone's celebrity or glamour, you know,
yeah.
that she was in awe of Anne Marie's glamour. And of Catherine Ann Porter, too, for instance, because,
oh, yeah.
you know, everything I've read about Catherine Ann Porter was that she was very sort of glamorous. You know, it's interesting, isn't it, that these are the kinds of women that Carson fell in love with that seem sort of unattainable and are so, you know, out of her sort of realm of experience, it seems to me.
Oh, yeah. She was like, I was very much, you can see that in her as a girl when she's talking all the time about what she would wear when she had her debut at Carnegie Hall. I mean, she loved the kind of glamour and glitz, you know, very attracted to it. And even though they aren't somebody with Catherine Ann Porter ever dream of being in a relationship with. But Catherine Ann Porter was beautiful. She had that head of white hair when she was quite young and was so beautiful that she was so striking that I'm not at all surprised that Carson had a crush on her. That's the kind of woman who attracted her. Yes, I don't know whether for a relationship, but she wasn't always looking for a relationship. I guess, sort of like a lot of us, you know, we have terrible crushes and we think that's who we want to have a relationship with, but it really isn't or wouldn't work or whatever.
This makes me think of something that I've been asking a number of my interviewees, and that is about Carson's sexuality. And, you know, as we said, Jen Chaplin, her whole book is partly an argument for the fact that Carson was basically a closeted lesbian. And Carlos Deuce, you know, someone I would say probably the world's foremost scholar right now of Carson McCullers,
right.
and he says in an early sort of piece of writing that he published in Columbus about Carson and Reeves that they were both bisexual. And I had on the podcast Sarah Schulman, who's written a lot about
right.
Carson McCullers. And,
I've heard those, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, and she says, I think Carson would be a transgender man
yeah.
if she were living today. I don't know. But you say you think lesbian. So I'm just wondering how you came to that conclusion. And what do you think about this? The fact that people who seem to know her work so well disagree about that.
Well, a couple things. I agree that Reeves was probably bisexual. And I think that Jen Chapley says in the book that he was homophobic. And I can't see that at all. I mean, I see him as being very tolerant of say lesbians, and then yeah, of course he had a lot of times he wanted to go to bed with men and not just the affair with David Diamond, and I think Carson tried to get a couple of threesomes going clearly to make Reeves happy. But you know, one of the things about Carson that I was struck by is when she wrote a really long letter to Kay Boyle, the writer Kay Boyle, about Anne Marie. It's like a 15-page letter, and she didn't usually write letters that long, but she is really good at describing sexual desire. I'm not sure, I don't have a good memory for these things, the exact way she worded it, but it was whatever. And then she went and said something about Reeves and said, I've never had that feeling with Reeves. You know, it's convincing. I mean, you know, I'm sure if you're looking for that, you'll see it too. You know, it's the way a lot of people feel, just kind of dizzy and, you know, great, but it's kind of scary and all that. And you know, Reeves and sex with Reeves, I don't even know how often, you know, that was happening. I think that she didn't really, I would guess, I have no idea. This is the other thing is we have no idea. You know,
yeah.
We really don't have any idea. And I think the other thing that's going on in Shapley's book is that she would like to claim this relationship as lesbian or that one as Reeves as not a genuine heterosexual relationship and so forth. And that's always true. We have our own versions of people that we read biographies of, and that's totally valid. And also the time shape it, you know, and somebody who then doesn't seem to have been acting like a lesbian, we can say now, oh, but the thing is, we have no way of knowing. I mean, it's almost comical. There was a piece in the New Yorker about Red Cloud, Nebraska, where they're building a Willa Cather Center, and there's a Willa Cather scholar there that they're talking to. And Cather was, of course, a lesbian, and she lived most of her life with this woman, Edith Lewis. You know, there's a whole lot of lesbian subtext in what she writes. It's a, a very interesting part of her, but she was so not out and she wanted her letters burned, and they were, and so forth. But the scholar said, you know, what do you want? She said, the letters are written to them jointly for over 40 years, and they're together for 40 years. And do you need a picture of them in bed together? You know, can't we get beyond this? I mean, can't we just assume that things are the way they are? I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but you can't always tell somebody's heterosexual until they have children. That's your proof, right? That's the proof. That's the only proof, you know, though there's probably more, you know, footage of, I don't know, of heterosexuals, but you can't tell. And it sounds silly, but it's really important to keep in mind. We don't know.
It's absolutely true. You know, on that subject, one of the more surprising things about Carson's life in the 40s and 50s is that at one point she is pregnant. And it was like, wow, who saw that coming? You know, that is one of the more shocking things. And, you know, I think it was, correct me if I'm wrong, but her mother was among those who said, oh, no, she cannot be given birth. You know,
no.
She's just not strong enough. She's not, you know, strong enough to go through this, which is probably true because her health was so bad. But
she has I found something very late. I think it's Hortense Kalischer, who, you know, lived out in Rockland County near them, and where they talk about, Carson says, you know, no, I never wanted to have children, and says pretty explicitly that I couldn't be a writer. But I think, and she couldn't, can you imagine? Yeah, no, let's not even go there, Carson is a mother. But I mean, even carrying a baby to term, I can't imagine it. And she wasn't well enough, okay, physically, the stroke, and emotionally she wasn't. And everybody, I think, knew that. But it is odd that it's her mother. I mean, her mother was not like your usual mother, and she participated in Carson's life a lot. But yeah, I was struck by that too. And it was right during, wasn't it during the rehearsals for Member of the Wedding?
I think it's around that time. I don't remember exactly, but yeah, it's in that really muddled period of late 40s, early 50s, you know, when she's back with Reeves. Like I said, it's one of the many surprising things about her life. And, you know, her physical condition, her medical issues and so forth, it's stunning. I mean, we know about the strokes, but that's just the beginning of, you know, all of the terrible things that she went through.
If you want to, I mean, this is not a selling point for my book at all. I realize that, but almost the biggest thing that I realized or came to understand about her is that it was so tragic, you know, dying at 51 and getting that stroke at that age and being that, and getting a stroke from a whole sequence of medical events that didn't have to happen. You know, it's just absolutely tragic. She didn't write that much. Well, of course she didn't write that much. You know, she was barely able to type or write. And it just, how truncated her life is. And the strokes really came when she's written her best work, you know, and not that, I mean, I think Clock Without Hands is a real achievement, but it's kind of stuck out there by itself too. Yeah. And it's just horrendous to think about.
1951, 12 p.m. to Lieutenant or LT Mr. Reeves McCaws Nyack. Precious have written, staying at wonderful club in country, well, happy, and working furiously at poem. Love to family, your own, Carson. Now, beloved. Dearest Reeves Dash, your letter that came this morning filled me with such tenderness and pride. You are, underlined, coming through. Now, what you need is a vocation, spelled above clearly, V-O-C-A-T-I-O-N. I wonder what you think of the ambition you once had, Dash, to be a doctor. Now that I am no longer a financial responsibility, and with the help of Uncle Sam, it is just practical, Dash, if that is what you want. Page 2. You have a pure and scientific mind, period, and such great love, humanity. I was thinking of Catherine. She only started her studies at the age of 37, Dash. She is now 46. And she has she had had to stop high school at 14 to earn a living, but she dedicated herself to her studies, and now she is the best, one of, as far as out there, doctor in the world for me. Her reputation in medical circles is extraordinary. After only 4 years as a qualified MD, she heads a department at St. George's, Page. It would be a matter of intensive work, and that would be good for you. I am living at a country club that Catherine and Hugh Gainsborough, parentheses, my other doctor at St. George's, parentheses again, hospital, parentheses, arranged. It is 1.5 hours from London, 1.5 something from London, and the loveliest place anyone ever imagined. The staff is sublimely kind, the country marvelous, and the food, exclamation. Never have I had such meals, dash. It is cooked by Paige, the wonderful woman who owns it. The wonderful woman who owns the place crossed out, so to speak, club, parentheses, it is a club until, parentheses, the cost is crossed out, including something crossed out, is about $35 a week, dash, incredible, period. The people are so lovely. Must get to work on my poem. All love to you. And you know how I love you, darling, and I am always thinking of you, your inner peace and energy. Over. Again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Carson McCullough Center's weekly We of Me. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more at mccullerscenter.org or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. This podcast was brought to you by Columbus State University's Carson McCullough Center for Writers and Musicians and by Columbus State University's recording studio. The music you heard during the intro and outro was written by Lilia Uge in honor of Carson McCullough's 100th birthday on February 19th, 2017. I'm Nick Williams, technical director for these podcasts, and I hope you have a great day. Margaret Sullivan's cassette tape recording of her reading from Letters from Carson McCullers to Reeves McCullers is in the Margaret Sullivan Papers in the Columbus State University Archives.